Welcome to Warships Pod. A new Cold War between Russia and NATO is underway, including what has been called a fourth Battle of the Atlantic by a top US Navy admiral. And as we like a bit of history, in addition to discussing current day navies and their activities, I will from time to time in the course of Warships Pod talk to some Cold War naval warriors who saw service in the previous such contest. The aim is to gain insights into what it was like last time around, enabling us to perhaps understand some enduring truths of sea power. In that way, we offer discussions that are complementary to the reports, commentaries, and analysis published in Warships IFR magazine itself. What makes this episode's guest especially important for me is that I have, in two books, Hunter Killers and HMS London, written about his amazing career in the submarine service and also as a surface warship captain. Captain Doug Littlejohns has some amazing stories to tell, not only about facing the Russians under the waves as a submarine captain, but also in command of an anti-submarine warfare and intelligence-gathering warship. I was fortunate enough to sail in the same warship on an historic voyage to Russia, though sadly, not at the time Doug was in command. Welcome to Warships Pod, Doug.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be here.
I wonder if we could kick off with a quick summary of how you came to join the Royal Navy and why you picked a life at sea in a blue suit as service in the senior services corps.
Well, I've been doing some homework on genealogy, and my dad's family came from Cornwall. I've got back to 1600 now. And throughout that time, there was somebody at sea, either in the Royal Navy or in the Merchant Navy, serving in various ranks from Barber Surgeon to Vice Admiral Sir William Littlejohns, who was on the Admiralty Board in 1916 at the time of the Battle of Jutland. So I knew I had a naval history, but until I was 14, I actually wanted to be a school teacher, teaching history or Latin and running the cricket team. But then my father came home one night with his paper, and in it was a coloured advertisement for the Royal Navy, a young midshipman in tropical whites, surrounded by bikini-clad girls at the Singapore Officers Swimming Club. So I decided to apply.
So it's the usual sort of thing that got you interested, travel abroad and exotic people and climates, was it?
Yeah, and a 14-year-old boy suddenly had a change of heart, and I don't regret it for one minute.
No. And during your time as a midshipman, you served aboard a commander carrier east of Suez, as I know from having written about your career myself. And it was commanded by Godfrey Place, a submariner and Victoria Cross winner, who was involved in an attack on the Tirpitz. But I think in those days, there were quite a few World War II veterans still around to show youngsters like yourself the ropes. Was that the case?
Oh, yes, there were. First of all, I was in a minesweeper in the Persian Gulf, Bahrain, where the captain was Captain Carver, who'd had a very good war record. He was the captain of the naval base. And then I went to HMS Albion in Singapore, where Godfrey Place, who was the purpose-built submariner, he was quite small and quite punchy. But at that stage, I didn't think about being a submariner, because I wanted to be a sea vixen pilot, which is why I joined the Navy. But there were lots of veterans around, and my father had been in destroyers during the war, serving in the Mediterranean, Indian Ocean, and the Far East. And he gave me stories about people like Cunningham and Somerville and Mountbatten, who, towards the end of my father's career, picked him to be his communicator and took him from his position, Flag Officer Malta, to the Admiralty and to running the Whitehall Compsen.
Right. And you mentioned aviation there, Fly Navy being a famous slogan for the fleet Aeron. But flying in a jet in the 1960s Royal Navy was quite a risky proposition. So that didn't put you off at all?
It didn't put me off, but it put off the appointers, because I was originally going to be a pilot. I'd passed the test. But then the Navy decided to have this new scheme of sending 8 seaman officers, executive officers, to university instead of going back to Dartmouth for their third year. And while I was there, I got a letter from the Admiralty saying, we're not spending all this money on your education for you to disappear off the face of the earth with a flight deck accident. So you better think of a different specialization. And I was given a sheet with 6 lines on it. And in a fit of pique, I wrote submarines in all six. And that's how I changed from being in the air to underwater.
So as a boy, you hadn't read Edward Young's incredible memoir about being a commander of HMS Storm in World War II. So you didn't have a sort of fascination for submarine life then, before that?
No, not particularly. While we were in Singapore, I went down on board a couple of A-class submarines. And I thought they were pretty dirty and smelly and cramped. But actually, when after 2 years in the Navy and time at university, I thought, well, they're actually proper weapons of war fighting. And that appealed to me. And I then did read Edward Young's book.
Right. And when you went under the sea, this would what be the mid-1960s? Would that be in your first submarine that you went to sea in?
When I was at university, we went to did things with the Navy and during our vacation time. So in Easter 1967, I went to HMS Ambush, commanded by a wonderful man called Chris Wood, who was my ideal of a perfect submarine captain. And we went out in the English Channel and dived, and this was quite an old submarine, so it leaked through the conning tower, which I thought was a bit disconcerting. And then I thought this mad captain then said, well, we'll solve that, and he went deeper. And of course, that put additional pressure on the conning tower hatch and stopped the leak. So the first few minutes of being in a dive submarine were a bit traumatic.
Right, but you obviously, it did put you off, because you went into the submarine service, or the trade, as it's called. And what was it like in a diesel-electric submarine of that era? I mean, there are no more diesel-electric submarines in the Royal Navy today. It's a nuclear-powered fleet. But back then, there were quite a lot of submarines, weren't there? And some of them were rather old and vintage.
Oh, yes. We had T-class, A-class, P-class, and O-class. And I just loved the camaraderie, the lack of formal discipline. Having served in a minesweeper in the Gulf and then an aircraft carrier in the Far East, I much preferred the small ship life and the ability to know each and every member of the crew, who would also know you, of course. And it was just a fantastic feeling of togetherness. Everybody was a professional. There's no room for a passenger. And you all depended on each other. It just appealed to appealed to my spirit.
I mean, they've been described as, you talked about your Cornish roots, but they've been described as being piratical submarine crews, and also the boats themselves called the dirty boats. So was it that kind of almost buccaneering sense of living and working?
Yes. I mean, if anybody's seen the movie Das Boot, HMS Ambush was not a lot different from the German submarines in that film. Nobody wore uniform except in harbour, and then with some reluctance. You just rubbed along very well with each other. It was dirty. Yep, you couldn't have a shower or anything like that. The design of the submarine was interesting in that the main galley where the food was prepared was opposite the heads. Are the toilets, and any problem in the heads rather ruined the meal. So it was a different way of life, quite alien if you haven't experienced it, but thoroughly enjoyable.
And you obviously took to it, and so ultimately that would lead to you becoming the captain of a submarine. But what was your path to that decision? I mean, did you decide you'd like to command one of these boats after a while, or were you selected fairly early on? How did that happen?
Well, two things. I mean, the second time I went to sea in Ambush was, I think, a summer vacation. And it was doing the Perisher running, that's the command qualifying course. And on that course was a Lieutenant Toby Frere, who 10 years later, or 9 years later, was the teacher, or one of the teachers on my Perisher course. And I watched these chaps being put through their paces by the then teacher. It was a quite bellicose chap. And it was, as a trainee, it was enlightening and amusing to see the tricks that they got up to. But I thought, I could do that. And so it didn't take me very long to think, look, I can crack this and I'll do that. And then as my career progressed through through diesel boats, I didn't serve in a nuclear until after I commanded a diesel submarine. I happened to be in the right place at the right time and found myself on Perisher in January 75.
The Perisher is world famous, rightly so, for its high quality of training, and also it's quite ruthless weeding out of anybody that won't actually make the grade, because of course, you know, submarine crew depends upon the captain, whether they live or die, and also the country itself for defence. So when you got the letter, or when you were told that you were going to be going forward to the Perisher course, was that something that you received with some trepidation, or did you see it as your moment to kind of consume this amazing experience?
Well, there's clearly trepidation because you know the reputation of the course, but I reckon I could do it. And so I was delighted to be selected reasonably early and in my submarine time. And I couldn't wait to get stuck into it. And I thoroughly enjoyed the course. But as you say, it has a reputation for being ruthless. Many of the people who didn't make the cut, as it were, knew that they weren't going to do that. And one of the things about a good teacher, and I had a teacher called Rob Forsyth, working alongside Toby Frere, whom I mentioned earlier, was he made sure that you either realised that you were going to pass or you realised that you couldn't hack it. And we had one chap who failed on my half of the course, and he was relieved because he knew, and the crew knew that it wasn't for him. And that's one of the really good things about the Perisher, is that the submarine crew actually sees their future commanding officers being put through this ringer, and so they are actually very good at forecasting who will pass and who will fail.
I remember somebody telling me, it's probably you or somebody like Rob Forsyth, telling me that they would actually assess who would pass or fail and take bets. Is that right?
Oh, yes. There was a tote board up in the forward mess, as they called it, up near the forward torpedo tubes, and they'd run a tote up there. And that would be up and running within the first week of the sea time. And I don't think I ever saw them being wrong. One of the things I tried to do was to sneak forward when I was on the Perisher to see if I could find the board, but I couldn't. They'd hidden it.
Oh, I see. Right.
But I felt good because there was a leading cook who always turned up in my attacks. He wrote on the back of the time bearing plot in reverse writing with a Chinagraph pencil. And he wore a leather World War II flying helmet. So when I was attacking, so I thought that was a pretty good sign.
Right. So, I mean, just for listeners who may not be up to speed on this, when you say attacking, what you mean is when you were on the periscope in command of the submarine, when the submarine was being put through a series of tests.
Yes.
By a charging frigate. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. There were six students per course, and we rotated through as the captain, the second in the command team, who'd be sure the attack coordinator, the navigator, a man who operated the calculator, and a few other jobs. And you were the duty captain put against starting one frigate, which would charge straight at the periscope or do manoeuvres as already arranged by the teacher with the commanding officers of the frigates, who used to be quite nervous sometimes about charging the submarine periscope because they were worried they might hit us. But teacher's job was to make sure that we ducked underneath them before it was too bad. And you'd work up over a period of 4 weeks to having four frigates and an RFA or a tanker. And you'd have to penetrate between these four frigates who'd be rushing around at high speed so that you could carry out a mock attack on the tanker, during which time, of course, if things were going too well, teacher would then throw some stunts in to try and distract you.
Yeah. And what were some of those? Perhaps you could tell us a bit about those.
Well, there was one I remember very well, which was used on almost every parish, of course. And that you're in the middle of your attack. You've got stopwatches hanging from your waist. You've got one on your wrist. You've got two around your neck. And all these watches are showing times of when you have to go and look at a particular ship. And all of a sudden, a couple of chaps would turn up in the back end of the control room shouting, fire, 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 and bringing in a hose. And if you didn't sort this out, their job was to walk around the student on the periscope and trap him. That was one. Another one was Rob Forsyth thought I was getting on rather well, so he told me I'd got plenty of time, and so he told me to run back to the after torpedo compartment and ask the chap who was on watch there his birthday, and then rush back again. And I think I had about 1 minute and 30 seconds to do it, and I did it in plenty of time, but it was just to make a point. And the third one, with the most heinous, was he asked his petty officer steward and the ship's steward to have a mock fight in the passageway leading to the front of the control room. And I was in the middle of an attack, and I said to my attack coordinator, who was a Dutchman called Driekus Hay, go and sort that out, bang the heads together. So he did. Well, he didn't. He punched one. And of course, it wasn't a proper fight, but petty officer steward said, I'm never doing that again, because as he was nursing a sore chin. But that's what it was, something to distract you. And then in the evenings, of course, we were staying in a hotel in Rothsay, we would have lectures and maybe pile in a few whiskies, because one of the things that teacher was doing was to make sure that we were tired, so that he could assess us when we were not 100% fitness. And that was quite a test as well. But I enjoyed it.
Yeah. And then I suppose he was testing you to the limit so that when you were on a patrol in whatever submarine you're in command of, that you would be able to cope with multiple things being thrown at you, and also when you're very tired and worn out. So I suppose it was all for the good. Yeah.
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, the one thing that everybody comes away from the perisher with on something you've passed is that you know when you're getting to a point where you can no longer cope. You find out what your limit is. And anybody who tries to operate outside their limit is heading for exit. So, you know, you come off parish thinking you can walk on water, but you know deep down what your limits are.
So, I mean, you came through parish and you were told the minute you finished the course or passed the course that you had a submarine command. How did that happen?
Yes, we finished an exercise off the Isle of Arran. Submarine surfaced and started making its way back into Faz Lane. And one by one, the survivors were called into to see the teacher, who was in the captain's cabin with a glass of champagne. I walked in. He said, congratulations, Doug. You've passed and you're about to command HMS Osiris. And that was one of the highlights of my life.
Yeah, I bet it was. Fantastic. So Osiris, Oberon class diesel electric submarine. So yep. You were sent to what, Gosport, to take command?
Yes. The O class submarines were state of the art in the 1960s. We're now talking about, I took command in June 1975, but they were state of the art. We'd sold them to Canada, Australia, Chile, Brazil, and they could not be a quieter for that time of naval development. And I was based in the 1st Submarine Squadron in Gosport, HMS Dolphin, which was the alma mater of the submarine service. And I was fortunate to command her for 18 months, during which time we had a number of interesting encounters with Soviets.
Yeah, I wonder if you could tell us about some of those.
Well, one of the first things I had to do was to take the submarine up to north of Ireland, to where the Soviets had placed one of their intelligence gathering purpose-built ships called a Primorye, which was a big ship, about 5,000 tons, full of intelligence gathering equipment. And it was there to try to intercept or track one of our Polaris submarines exiting to go on patrol. OSIRIS was sent there to be a distraction. Anyway, we got there. The Polaris submarine was not yet due, so I was hanging around. I thought I'd nip underneath this Primorye and take some photographs of its underside to see if there were any special sonar fits or anything like that. And we did that, but the ship was almost hove to. So we maneuvered underneath. Periscope was about no more than 10 feet away from the hull of the ship. And it was quite a swell, so the ship went up in the swell, and we went up with it. And then the ship came down, but we didn't. Luckily, I dropped the periscope in time before the ship sat on it. And I decided that I'd probably done enough of underwater looks against the stationary ship. So we pulled out to one side. And then later on in the day, we deliberately exposed the periscope so that he would see it and then come chasing after us while our other submarine escaped out and I'd go on patrol.
But just to fill in on some of the technicalities of that exciting sort of encounter, when taking a photograph of the underside of a vessel like that Russian intelligence gathering ship between Scotland and Ireland, the camera that you took the image with would be actually attached to the periscope, and then you would trigger it when you thought it was the right moment?
Yes. It was quite a standard manoeuvre to do what's called underwater look. The search periscope, which was binocular and they're quite sturdy, would be the one you'd put up. And it was far easier to take an underwater look when the target was moving at something less than 8 or 9 knots. And then you'd approach from astern, get underneath, work out your heights very carefully, and start with a range of, say, 10 feet at the top of the periscope. And then, depending on water clarity, you might have to ease up a little bit. But that I never went closer than 6. Well, that's quite close enough, I think. And then we had cine cameras and still cameras. So we could go up and down the hull of the target, taking photographs and also at the same time recording any sonar sounds from it, which was all good for intelligence gathering. Exciting, but fun. More fun if you were doing it against a submarine, which, of course, can dive at any moment. But the distances are so close that you don't need to move very much to get out of the way.
And that sort of thing, gathering intelligence with a submarine, unseen, you know, we come unseen, unheard, was more difficult when you were sent somewhere like, say, the Mediterranean or somewhere like that? Did you ever do anything like that there?
The clarity in the Mediterranean was a lot better than off Ireland and in the Clyde. And we were tasked en route to Karachi in OSIRIS to look at some anchored Soviet ships in the Mediterranean. And, of course, they were stopped and they had great big anchor cables holding them in position. So going underneath them was quite a challenge. We knew the depth we could be at. We knew the depth of water underneath us. So that wasn't the problem. The problem was not blundering into the anchor cable. But we managed to get some photographs of their Moskva, as was then a helicopter carrier, and get away without damaging ourselves. But it was great for ship's company morale, because you had the beaming faces when we'd finished that little episode and we're on our way to Alexandria. Was a joy to behold.
Yeah, and I suppose the clarity that helped you see the target, you know, the photographic target, was also going to quite obviously mean that a submarine like OSIRIS would be seen in the sea quite obviously and instantly if anybody looked over the side, like tipping potato peelings over the side, wouldn't it?
Well, that's why it's best to get underneath the ship as quickly as you can, because they can't see through the ship. But Yes, approaching, always approach from the quarter, i.e. not immediately right astern, because you might then drive into the anchor cable, but from sort of 135 degrees either side of the bow, and get there as quickly as possible, and then catch almost as what they call a stop trim underneath to try to be doing less than half a knot, so that you could actually get some decent photographs. But yes, I mean, but trouble is, well, no, not the trouble. The good thing is that when the ships are at anchor, they're not really looking over the side for submarines poking around underneath them. So.
And were there any other notable things you'd like to talk about there, or shall we move through to the nuclear-powered Navy and just find out a bit?
Well, yes, I mean, there's at the bottom of the Red Sea, there's or in the Arabian Sea, which was used by the Soviets for anchorages as well. And we had a look in there, but it's quite a challenge. But yeah, we did it. But it was so hot that day that I doubt if anybody on the Soviet ships was even outside in the fresh air, as it were, inside in their air conditioning.
Yeah, yeah. And I presume that with that kind of mission completed and whatever intelligence you gathered dispatched off to whoever needed to look at it, you would then be able to give the Happy Submariners a run ashore.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, we went to we were in Karachi for quite a while trip. And we're the first RN submarine to go through the Suez Canal since 1956, which was noteworthy. And the boys enjoyed their time in Karachi very much.
So having taken Osiris east of Suez and on various adventures, you then graduated to, or you then moved over to the nuclear-powered submarine world. So how did that happen, and how different was that from the so-called dirty boats of the diesels?
Well, actually, I'd done the nuclear training course, so I was ready to go. And my job after Osiris in Portsmouth was to come to Plymouth as the 2nd Submarine Squadron Warfare Officer. And fairly quickly after I got there, I was put on board HMS Swiftsure, our newest submarine at the time, to go on a northern patrol, as it was called. And I couldn't believe the comfort. My first day at sea, I had a shower. We went deeper and faster than I've ever gone before. We had a really good meal, and we showed the movie without the movie projector being angled at the back of somebody's cap in the wardroom. It was a joy, and I could stand up everywhere and not bang my head.
So those were immediate benefits to going into submarines. Yeah. Yeah. And so in terms of the custom or the way of operating, was it radically different from the diesels? No, not so much piratical, more like business and corporate?
Really quite different. Much more formal. Well, not as formal as an aircraft carrier, but we wore a uniform, and the captain had passed the parachute, and also the XO. So you had two commanding officers and what called the watch leaders, who were in charge of each watch, and there were two watches, were very experienced lieutenants. And it was much more of a collegiate atmosphere than in a diesel boat, where the captain is literally a one-man band, because he's the only one who's looking through the periscope. The tactical data handling system is in his head. Whereas on a nuclear boat, you've got computer generated actual information organization. You've got a lot of experienced people, and it's a completely different approach, a much more powerful weapon too.
So in 1981, you were asked to take command of HMS Scepter, sister vessel to the Swiss shore. So what was it like having observed and gained some experience in a nuclear-powered submarine to actually be given command of such a powerful beast?
Well, it was quite a shock to start with, because I wasn't expecting to go to HMS Scepter. The submarine had been involved in a collision. The MOD called it with an iceberg. And I was planning to go to a different submarine altogether. But I've got what we call a pierhead jump on a Thursday when Flag Officer Submarines asked me into his office at midday and said, I want you to take over Sceptre on Monday. So I was it was quite an interesting time. And I got to Plymouth, HMS Drake, on the Sunday evening to have a nightcap before I took command of the submarine the next morning. And then a young man came up to me and said, hello, I'm David Russell, I'm your new XO. I was joining at 10:30 in the morning and David joined at midday. So it was quite a chilling moment when I looked at the Sceptre for the first time. It was in dry dock in Plymouth. It looked like a half-eaten, black, stranded whale on a beach. Quite a lot of the front of the submarine was missing, as was the top of the fin. And there were cables and wires hanging out from everywhere. And the ship's company was, I think the best term I can use is fragile. They'd had a horrendous experience. And the first challenge, apart from getting on board and finding my way to the cabin, was to say, well, I've got to do something. We have got to do something about the ship's company, faith and morale, when we go to sea again. And years later, I compared notes with Admiral Sandy Woodward, who'd had been in exactly the same situation when he took over HMS Warspite some 10 or 12 years earlier, which had also had a collision. And we found that we pretty much did similar things to get the ship's company up and running.
Yes. So Sceptre had, like Warspite, had met a particularly voracious iceberg. and you had been sent down there. I mean, it's hard for any person, normal person, should we say, beyond a submariner. Not that I'm saying submariners aren't normal. I'm just saying for any civilian or person like me to imagine you standing there on the side of the dry dock at Devonport in Plymouth and seeing this, as you say, stranded whale that had been savaged. So the process of taking a boat, because submarines are called boats, from, and this is a large one, obviously, from that condition, badly beaten up and wounded, as it were, along with the crew that, you, as you say, was fragile. That is something I think most people would just find beyond them to do. But of course, you were produced by a system and a lot of experience, so you were able to do that. So can you just give us a brief idea of the steps that you then got that submarine back to being a member of the frontline fighting fleet?
Yes, the submarine had been involved in this collision in May of 1981. And I joined in September and we went to sea in December and took it very gently out of the dry dock and out west of Ireland into some deep water. And of course, the first thing is the trim. Lots of changes have been made to the weights and the disposition of weights in the submarine. So a lot of calculations have been done to make sure that when we opened the main vents, one, we sank, but two, that we didn't sink too quickly and hit the bottom. So that was the first test, get that done. Now, I remember that the crew was jumpy and so we got underwater and then slowly, with lots of checks, went down to maximum diving depth. And there were some sweaty faces and white faces around when we did that. And then the engineer reported that we were all right, no leaks. And then I embarked on an hour of stupidity, throwing the submarine around like a fighter aircraft at high speed and big angles, and breaking lots of crockery, which you could hear tumbling out from all places because they hadn't been stowed properly. But by the end of that, the crew were laughing and joking and there were no white faces and confidence was back. And that's what it took. But I enjoyed that bit and they knew thereafter that I would throw it around whenever I wanted to. and they had to be stored so that stuff didn't get broken. And that's how it worked.
And the objective was to restore the crew and the submarine to being an asset for the UK to take part in patrols out there in the Atlantic to try and counter the Soviet, the growing Soviet menace, as it were. So was that something that was fairly, not easy, but was that something that you soon found that the boat and the crew were able to slip back into?
Yes. As I said earlier, submariners are professionals and proud of their ability to cope with all sorts of obstacles thrown in their way. Scepter was fitted out with special equipment to collect intelligence at sea, and we always went to sea looking for trouble. That was our job. And when I say trouble, I mean looking for the Soviet Navy. And we trained for it. The crew had already been trained in that before I took over, we just had to get over that little problem with the fragility, as I call it. Once we did that and got back into the operations of things, it was good fun. And one of the good points about going up against a potential enemy is to be able to show to your crew and to show to themselves that they can do it and they're superior. And we sneak up behind Soviet ships and submarines and carry out mock attacks and then drift away, and they wouldn't know we'd been there. And every time you do that, it's a huge fillip to morale, and it gets the smiles wider and wider. So most enjoyable.
And so I realise some of this stuff is still covered, as I know well, by, shall we say, confidentiality or the code of omerta when it comes to submarine service, or just basically people don't want to talk about some of the details of it. I'm well aware of that. But are you able to say anything about some of the patrols that you might have taken out in the North Atlantic up towards the Arctic? Are you able to talk about that at all?
Yes. Submarine. The beauty part of submarine is nobody knows where you are. So we would leave Plymouth, and just west of the Eddiston Light, we would dive, and then a couple of months later, we'd come back and surface there and come back into Plymouth. As long as you stay in international waters, you're fine. And the world is your oyster, if you like. So we would go up into the Arctic Circle and the Barents Sea and places like that, and find the Soviet Navy exercising in their backyard and firing weapons and doing anti-submarine exercises, flying airplanes, attacking each other, firing missiles. It was an exciting time, and it was all part of the West making sure that we were up to date with whatever the Soviets were planning to throw at us. And also another part of that was, if you have if you've got submarines in the Norwegian Sea and around the corner in the Barents Sea, if there was any untoward rush activity of Soviet Navy rushing out somewhere, that you could be in a position to make sure that your bosses knew about it. So it was an important role, and it was fun.
But also, you went to the South Atlantic to loiter off, I believe,
yes.
Well, I know, off Argentina. And so that must have been a different kind of mission altogether.
Yes. This was not during the Falklands conflict. I went into Faslane in March or April 82 on our way to go north, but we'd had a little problem, so it needed mending, and there were the submarines loading up for war. And I immediately, because I had a war complement of weapons on board, went up and volunteered to go, and I was told quite firmly to get back in my box and stick with the program. But we then went down to the Falklands in January 1983. To use the part of the specialist equipment that we had on board to see what we could pick up in the way of intelligence about the Argentinians. And we were due to relieve a submarine called Warspite, I've mentioned before. But you know, after a few days down there, we developed a rather unpleasant defect, which was only going to get worse. And so we had to break away and hurtle back to the UK. But on the way down, we did do something I'd always wanted to do, which was to loop the loop of the equator. So we went under the equator, surfaced, came back on the surface. It was evening, sunset coming. Those who could came up on the deck, casing, and had a can of beer, watched the sun go down. Some of them were looking for a white line to show where the equator was, but having crossed the equator going north again, we then dived and went under it and went on down to the Falklands. It was, an interesting time.
Yeah. And I believe that when you were at sea in Scepter, sometimes you would, because obviously your second in command, the XO, was qualified to command the submarine, you would go on a bit of leave, as it were. And that's where you acquired a very important skill.
Yes. I get bored easily, and we were hanging around off Argentina, and I thought, no, I've got to do something else. And so I handed over to David Russell, who was the XO, changed into jeans and a t-shirt, and went back into the engine room and demanded access to a lathe. I'd never used one before, and I taught myself how to use a lathe and made a couple of almost matching candlesticks. They look quite like a pair as long as you keep them about 6 feet apart.
Oh, very good.
But it was interesting because I kept forgetting to take the chuck key out of the lathe when I'd tightened everything up. And so the crew were going past me on the lathe wearing tin hats because the chuck key would tend to fly out when I started the lathe up.
So having been the captain of a nuclear-powered submarine, an SSN as they're called as well, you then had to serve ashore. So, I mean, how was it for you as a thrusting young warrior of the deep to actually be a warrior of Whitehall or shall I say, captain of a desk? How did you take to that? Was that something you looked forward to or you found equally challenging?
Well, I had a gentle introduction to it because I went from Scepter to the underground bunker in Northwood to be the operations officer for the submarine service. And so I was in a lovely job working for Admiral Woodward, Sandy Woodward, and dealing with deploying our submarines and other nations, NATO submarines, against Soviet submarines coming down the Norwegian Sea. So that was a sort of slow ease down from being in command of a submarine. Then I did the Joint Services Defence College course, which trains you up for a job in the MOD. And then I was lucky enough to be selected for promotion to captain and sent off to the MOD as a four-stripe captain in my first job, which was interesting. To answer your point, some of my colleagues came to the MOD having been king of all they surveyed in a ship, and then found as an assistant director, as a baby captain, that they were sort of superannuated T-boy, and that some of them had great difficulty in adapting to that. But in the Nullarby, it was part of life's progression. So I enjoyed the MOD.
But while you were was it when you were at Greenwich that you were able to ask the question or a question of the Russian ambassador about the famous Whiskey on the Rocks incident of 1981, which was when a Russian diesel boat was stuck on some rocks, much to its own surprise, and discovered by the Swedes. And I believe you, although it was a few years later, you were able to ask a pertinent question of the Russian ambassador.
Yeah, I'm afraid the Russian ambassador came to talk to us just after the they'd shot down the Korean airliner, if you remember that. And he had his KGB minder with him, who had his flip chart of answers. And whenever anybody asked a question, the KGB guy would flip through and then give the ambassador the speaking notes. So I was a bit bored with that. So I got up and said, right, like, I fully understand why you shot down the Korean airliner. There was a sharp intake of breath from my colleagues. They then said, well, surely then you would have understood if the Swedes had sunk the submarine that you stuck on the rocks outside the Karlskrona naval base. And the KGB man's face was a picture because he flipped through all his charts. He didn't have an answer for that. And the ambassador eventually said, well, the captain made a simple navigational error, but actually he was miles inside territorial waters. There was no navigational error. But I did get to sit next to the ambassador at lunch. He asked for me. And I did say to him, why are you still doing this at the age of 70 plus? And he looked at me and he said, I live in the embassy in London. And I have servants and staff and everything else. And if I retire, I'm going back to a one-bedroom flat in Moscow. What would you do?
Yeah, I could see why he wouldn't want to do that. Yeah, yeah, brilliant. But I mean, that time, we're talking about mid-1980s, I guess, early to mid-1980s. The Cold War seemed to be getting hotter, and the Russians were seemingly gaining on NATO in the quality of their submarines. And I suppose part of that was due to espionage, like Walker Whitworth, a famous spy ring in America, giving secrets to the Russians. So you were in the MOD. You'd been at sea very recently in a nuclear-powered submarine. And so you got a ringside seat to some of the machinations, shall we say, I was going to say shenanigans, of that part of the Cold War. So what was that like? What was that period like?
It was quite frightening in some respects because, due to Walker Whitworth, and there were other fellows as well, the Soviets caught us up, almost. They advanced like 15 years in about two. It seemed like that anyway, because when I was at sea, just a few years earlier, I was up against submarines called the Victor III, which were, okay, they were good submarines, and some of them were well handled, but we had the measure of them. But as a result of the spying, the Soviets produced the Akula, which is a step change in capability and quite similar to our submarines, quite similar to the Swiftsure Trafalgar class and the American 688s. And so life became more difficult. To find these and track them, and some of the COs had benefited also from other spying information on submarine tactics and so on, and some of the Soviets were very good indeed. And there was one who was nicknamed after my time, but he was one of my successors in Northwood as the Prince of Darkness.
And, I remember him. Yeah, the Prince of Darkness. I remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah, he got around, but yeah. So it was quite quite nasty. But the Americans had great difficulty in accepting initially that an American had been a traitor.
And this was, to clarify, this was Smiling Jack Walker, as he was called.
Walker
he was,
Whitworth, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. Whitworth was connected to him, and then their kind of family of spies who they served in the US Navy and conveyed all sorts of secrets, didn't they?
Yes, they did, yeah. And they gave away a lot. At the same time, the Soviets were also doing a lot of work on the industrial side, and they got hold of machines that could make their propellers much better than they could be milled better than anything they'd ever had before. And of course, anything you could do to reduce the noise makes your submarine more potent.
But you actually went on a trip to America, where you gained an insight into the shock the Americans felt at having found this whole group of spies within their setup, because of course they were used to people like Philby and McLean and Burgess and other traitors like the Portland spy ring in Britain giving away naval secrets or defense secrets. But now, you know, in the mid 80s, here they were with their own. So you got to see that in first person, didn't you, over in America?
Yes, it was quite a shock. As I said earlier, they found it very difficult to accept that red-blooded Americans had actually become traitors for money. And the Pentagon was, I went there with with the first Sea Lord's instructions to find out what I could, because my assistant director job in the MOD was looking after the deterrent force, strategic systems. So I had a rear admiral opposite number who was looking after their equivalent, a much bigger force. And the Americans wouldn't talk to our people in Washington, in the embassy. But William Staveley, who was the first Sea Lord, had a very good relationship with the American Chief of Naval Operations, and said that, you know, we need to know what's going on because it's our deterrent at risk here. And so I was allowed to go across and have a chat with my opposite number, who was quite forthcoming, but of course he always said, "You never heard it from me."
Yeah. I mean, that this all sounds very much like some kind of espionage. I was going to say John le Carré, but actually no, more like Tom Clancy, like some kind of techno thriller meets espionage, you know, blockbuster. And actually, there are not many people out there who have met Clancy and have worked with him, and we'll come to that later. But also, in your case, had a character in one of Clancy's books. Not named after him, but you inspired a character in one of his books, I believe.
Yes.
How did that happen? Come on.
Well, I did a lot of trips to America in the various jobs I had, because we work very closely together with the American Submarine Service. And when I was at Northwood running submarine operations, I went to Norfolk, Virginia to tell them what we'd been doing in a particular exercise where a load of Victor III submarines came hurtling down the Norwegian Sea and out into the Atlantic. And when I got to America, I went to stay with my chum, James Perrone, recently retired as the Constable of Windsor Castle, who was our man in the embassy. And it was a Friday night and I needed to go to sleep because I was jet-lagged. So he gave me a book called The Hunt for Red October and said, "That'll send you to sleep." Well, it didn't. I read it until breakfast. And then I was staggered by how much this chap Clancy knew. And I said, I had to meet him. I need to know where he got this information. And then when we went down to Norfolk that Monday, sure enough, Tom was down there signing books. So we got together and had dinner with at a friend's house, and his wife cooked dinner for six submarine captains and Tom Clancy. And I told Tom that I much admired his book and that he'd got most of it right, but a few things wrong, and he demanded to know what was wrong. I wouldn't tell him everything. But he then outlined his next book, which was going to be Red Storm Rising. And to a man, we didn't really approve of his opening chapter. And so we suggested some amendments, which he took on board. Anyway, the next thing I know is I'm sitting in the MOD 18 months later, and a shadow comes across my desk, and it's the first Sea Lord, William Staveley, saying, "I've just read a thinly disguised description of you in Tom Clancy's latest book." And right. he was not smiling, but
no,
I actually did in the end. But Tom did was to put my head on James's body and vice versa. So I became James Little, the CEO of HMS Trafalgar, and he became Doug Perrin, CEO of a Todoray frigate. William Staveley actually was secretly quite pleased because it was good PR for the Royal Navy.
Yeah, big kudos, very much, very much. But talking of frigates and people being in command of them, your next job was to be the commanding officer of HMS London. I think that was in 1987, a new anti-submarine and intelligence gathering warship and quite a big vessel. Can you tell us what you thought when you first saw your surface warship command and how different you thought it would be and how different it turned out to be compared to a submarine?
Well, I was quite shocked to start with. I mean, obviously, I'd seen surface ships through periscopes and things, but I'd never really been on one apart from maybe the odd lunch in Plymouth. But I drove down the jetty alongside London to go and have dinner with the previous commanding officer before I took over. And I thought I can't possibly handle this, it's far too big. But actually, in tonnage terms, it wasn't a lot bigger than HMS Scepter. It's just that there was more air inside it because it was made of thinner metal. And I got on board and decided that I would just carry on as I had done in a submarine. So, I got the ship's company together and told them that I would be a wandering captain. I'd walk around the ship every day and see what was going on. And so it was not that much different, although the social side was, in a submarine, the captain has breakfast in his cabin and then eats the rest of the time in the wardroom. In a surface ship, the captain is in his cabin the whole time, and my cabin was huge. I couldn't fill more than 10% of the stowage space when I first moved in. So that's a different way of life.
So HMS London is, I suppose, different in one major way, which is obviously very visible above the waves. And so one of the things that, I mean, you touched on it a little bit there, that you get is the need for the warship to do an ambassadorial role. So what kind of notable visits did you undertake in London as a warship ambassador?
Well, of course, the best visit you could ever have in a ship called London is to the Pool of London. And after I'd taken over in 1987, in the spring of 88, we had passed our training and workup, and we went off to London for a spectacularly good visit, which entailed obviously going up the Thames and through Tower Bridge, which was exciting because if you get your timings wrong, you become a permanent fixture of the Thames embankment on the way, because it's a very tight tidal window to get quite a big ship up alongside the Belfast. And once we were there, we were royally treated by the Lord Mayor and the city, including having a special lunch for the ship's company in the Mansion House, which the crew really enjoyed, and they took lots of photographs and still talk about it. And while we were there, the Lord Mayor was having a river pageant, and he asked me if I would fire a 13-gun salute to his pageant. So I didn't know much about firing guns, but I read a few books and sent a signal to the MOD saying that I was intending to do this unless anybody told me I couldn't. And the day before the pageant, I was being shown around the tower by the constable of the tower, and I told him I was going to fire this gun salute, and he said, "You can't do that." And produced a piece of paper which signed by Oliver Cromwell, saying that ships of the Navy could not fire their guns, uncover and fire their guns in the Pool of London. Anyway, we went ahead with it, and the newspapers were full of letters of outrage from various retired army generals about how we'd fired this gun salute in the pool. And I ended up getting a signal from the First Sea Lord saying, what have you done? And I pointed out that I'd asked permission several months earlier and never heard another thing about it. And then when we came to leave, had a superb visit, absolutely superb visit. Peter Stringfellow looked after the crew, gave them lots of tickets to his nightclubs and things like that. And I don't think anybody on board, of the 273 people on board, had anything but good things to say about the time in London. We came to leave, and the previous ship, RN ship, to leave the Pool of London had actually tried to turn round in the pool, which is not something you really want to do, and had ended up being smashed into London Bridge. So when we came to leave, there were more television cameras hanging off Tower Bridge than you've ever seen before. And the pilot was the same pilot. And he didn't understand that HMS London went sideways in high wind, and we had a high wind from the north straight across the Tower of London onto us, pushing us back onto the Belfast. So we had tugs, pulled us off, and we started tugging towards the bridge. But I'd got my engines running in case, and I needed to use them at full power ahead and astern to stop us hitting the ramparts of Tower Bridge. And we shot through the gap with the tug, which was on our stern, running as fast as he could so that we didn't run him down. And the tug on our bow, just being tugged along by us at speeds he'd never experienced backwards.
Blimey. But prior to the London, eventful London visit to London the city, there was actually a very interesting foray by the warship into the Baltic, which, having heard these stories myself from you before, is quite an exciting and amusing and insightful window on what was going on in a part of the Cold War that really doesn't receive a lot of attention. So can you just explain a little bit about how you went into the Baltic, why you went in there, and also maybe some of the stories? So they're pretty good stories about your encounters with the Soviets.
Well, HMS London was a Batch 2 Type 22 frigate fitted with an all-round intelligence gathering system called Outboard. And part of the final part of the workup training was to deploy this and see what we could get out of it. It was an American system. And so it was elected that we would go to the Baltic, which the Soviets saw as their private pond, and see what we could get. So not to attract any attention, we entered the Baltic between Sweden and Denmark at night, lit as a merchant ship with no radars going or anything like that. And so the first thing that the Soviets knew that we were there, when we were about 12 miles off the coast at Tallinn, on the eastern side of the Baltic. And they then went into overdrive, sending aircraft and ships to come and buzz us and look at us and see what we were up to. So we decided we'd have a bit of fun with these chaps. And there was a little hydrofoil missile patrol boat called a Matka, which was our shadow. And because we were only doing two or three, four knots, this chap had high-powered diesels. And so every hour or so, he had to go off for a burn-up to stop his engines coking up or something. So one day, he'd been quite surly and quite difficult, but we had a funeral service, and we brought up a coffin, a little one, and I got dressed up as a padre, and the ship's company got into the swing of things, and we had a burial service on the flight deck, and then dropped the coffin into the water, and then looked to show great consternation because it didn't sink. It wasn't meant to. And so we pulled away, and the Matka dived in and picked up the coffin. And inside the coffin was a bottle of famous Grouse, some informative magazine, shall we say, and a couple of copies of The Hunt for Red October in Russian, signed by Tom Clancy. Anyway, thereafter, the Matka was actually quite friendly and stopped being a pain and buzzing us all the time, and actually even talked to us occasionally on the VHF.
Yeah, I should think so too. And yeah.
towards the end of our time, I was just joking with one of my PWOs, principal warfare officers, and said, you know, I bet there's a submarine out here looking at us, because that's what I used to do. And I said, if I were in a submarine, I would be over there, and pointed at him, let's go over there and go active. And we went over and went active on our high-powered sonar, and second ping, boom, there was a submarine. So it obviously went deep because we went towards it. And we then ran up and down above it all night, taking echo sounder traces of its shape, and identified it as a Foxtrot class diesel submarine. And then in the morning, this chap obviously had enough of this, and we pulled off a bit and let him come up for some fresh air. And he surfaced, and then we did a high-speed circle around him, flashing good morning, hope you're having a nice day, and then disappeared. But it was good. Ship's company have really enjoyed stuff like that because it was good for morale, you know, that we actually nailed a Soviet submarine with our active sonar. And the chap who ran the sonar said, I've never had a Soviet contact. That was great.
Yeah, and I bet he talks about that even to this day. I bet he's delighted with that.
He probably. Yeah. And at the same time, the ship's company were also rigging up all sorts of make-believe missile and torpedo enhancements to the ship, using gash bags and black plastic bags and dustbins and whatever else. And the old Matka would come in and take lots of photographs of all this stuff and probably go home and think, I've got this great intelligence coup.
So, yeah, they thought they had something amazing. And in fact, it was just pranks.
Yeah.
Brilliant. But then you would post the trip to London, which came after the Baltic foray. You did actually take HMS London into a pretty serious part of the world where there were Iranian aircraft firing missiles and Iraqi aircraft firing missiles, and there were mines and threats to merchant shipping. That of course is the Gulf, the Arabian Gulf or Persian Gulf, whatever you want. So that area, that part of the world, has been in the news for the past 30 to 40 years. So at the time you went in 1988, was it a very tense and hot zone, would you say?
Well, we went out in a hurry because we were supposed to be, right, I'd got married for the second time in June of 88. And I thought we were going to have a month before we were due to sail for the Gulf. We sailed 5 days later and because one of the ships out there had broken down. And so we had a high-speed dash through the Mediterranean and stopped in Karachi for some fuel and restoration. And we were on station, but when we left Karachi, we were useless because 70% of the ship's company had conjunctivitis. It was unbelievable what they picked up. So we had to go to Oman and have a couple of days to get rid of that. And then off we went into the Gulf, which was, we arrived just after the Vincennes had shot down the civil airliner.
That's the USS Vincennes, the American cruiser, yeah?
Yes, yeah. It was tense. And so we started escorting merchant ships, which is interesting because if you've been used to doing maneuvers with naval ships, and they can turn on a sixpence and accelerate and decelerate and so on, but merchant ships, they're not like that. And you talk about taking half an hour to start turning a super tanker. So you had to make sure you kept them at a good arm's length. And then, of course, as you said, there were mines, there were Boghammer missile boats, which was rushing around from a little island just out after you got through the entrance to the Gulf. One day we had quite an exciting day because on the way up to the Straits of Hormuz, an Iranian frigate came up on our starboard side and pointed all his guns and radars at us. It was trying to threaten us. So we pointed all our missile radars and things at him. And I gone onto the VHF radio and said, I'd really prefer you not to do that. And I think he realized that if push came to shove, he was not going to win. So he disappeared. Then we got round the corner into the Gulf, and we had a report that there were five Boghammer patrol missile boats coming out to get in the way of our little convoy of, I think we had five merchant ships and us. So I sent up, we had two Lynx helicopters on the on London and a Sea King helicopter on the tanker further down the Gulf, and sent them to go and hover over the Boghammers and let them know that we meant business. And they turned around and went back into harbour. But there was that air of tension the whole time. I think the Iranians realised that the Royal Navy was actually being very professional out there. And grudging respect, I think, was what we gained.
Yeah, and with that deployment coming to an end, you brought London back. And were you then assigned again to a job ashore?
Yes, I was quite delighted, well, surprised and delighted, to be picked to be the principal staff officer to the Chief of Defence Staff in London. I joined in April 1989 as a Commodore. The Commodore was not a substantive rank at that time, but I got dressed up as a Commodore because the Army had a Brigadier and the Air Force had an Air Commodore, so the Navy had to make it look as though we were the same. And it could not have been a more exciting time, because during the course of my time, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, the Berlin Wall came down, Tom King had his options for change, and it was hard work. But it was interesting to see how government operates and works from quite close by.
So you mentioned Tom King and options for change, which was a process of gaining the peace dividend, cutting the UK military quite drastically. But you, at this time in your career, you were given a job of running, or the job of running, the Royal Naval Engineering College at Manadon down in Plymouth. So was that something that you found to be extremely challenging, you know, a time when they were trying to cut things back and you were trying to keep a vital part of the Navy going?
Well, after being the PSO to the Chief Defence Staff, I took an MBA at Warwick Business School rather than do the Royal College of Defence Studies, because I thought I could see senior officers in the military being bamboozled by civil servants who had all been to Harvard with MBAs. So I volunteered to do one of those, which proved to be quite a good move in the end. But the net result of that was that the First Sea Lord thought it'd be a spiffing wheeze to send me to Manadon College to try to save it from defence cuts. I thought I'd had an arrangement to improve the lot of Plymouth University and let them have 110 acres of prime land in Plymouth and keep a naval contingent available to do engineering degrees. But it was not to be. And so while I was there, the closure of Manadon was announced, and that was my cue to leave.
And the connection with Tom Clancy, which we can come on to now, I guess, because it's very interesting what you did post your Royal Navy career. I know you did other things, but that particular bit for our listeners, I'm sure. In 1990, you actually had the honour of introducing the London premiere of a movie, namely The Hunt for Red October, which shows that your connection with Tom Clancy, who we can talk about again in a minute, had carried on. So how did you come to be the person that got up on the stage and introduced that well-known Hollywood movie?
The evening was hosted by Young and Rubicam, which was the advertising company which had the advertising contract for Royal Navy recruiting. And I was a friend of the managing director, so he invited me along. And I stood in front of all these great leaders of British industry and thought, well, how the hell am I going to make this interesting? And so I said, look, imagine you're sitting here in London in your submarine, and you detect a Soviet submarine in Birmingham. And then our job is then to wind our way over to meet him and intercept him in Bristol. And they said to me afterwards, that gave them a far better idea of what it's like, rather than sort of Hollywood stuff where it all happens at 100 yards. It was a good movie, and it went down well.
Yeah. And so how did you segue, as it were, from your naval career into a significant career with Tom Clancy in setting up Red Storm Games? How did that happen?
Well, I left the Navy and I went to be the MD of Earls Court and Olympia in London, during which time Tom and I were conversing by fax, because emails hadn't appeared then. Then one day he said that he'd got involved with a software company and had asked them to make a submarine computer game, and would I care to give them some advice? He flew me over for the weekend to his house on the near Baltimore, and I met these chaps. I didn't know anything about computer games, but I could see that they had something. But I talked to them about the business setup they had, and when they'd all gone, I got up early on the Sunday morning and wrote a 2-page MBA type thing to Tom, saying, you know, it doesn't matter if this is a world number one game, you'll never see any money from it, because the boys have been stitched up by the publisher. So if you're going to get involved with computer games, you ought to form your own company with people who are businessmen, not just gamers, and maybe make some money out of it. About 3 months later, he turned up on our doorstep in London and said, "Oh, I've taken your advice. I'm forming a company and I want you to come and run it." And I said, no, that's not what I intended at all. He flew me and Debs over to the States, and we met these guys, and we went to the Greenbrier where Tom had a house, and we played some golf and flew back. And then my wife said to me, "You know, I really don't want to live with you 20 years down the road when you're in your bath chair saying, 'I wish we'd done that.'" And so I said, "Right, okay." So I resigned from Earls Court and Olympia, and in September 96, we flew to North Carolina, and I started up a company called Red Storm Entertainment. It was going to be Patriot Games, but Paramount Pictures had copyright on that, so we couldn't do that. So it was Red Storm Entertainment, taken from Red Storm Rising, and went from there.
And those computer games you came up with, I mean, the most notable one, I think, that I think even my kids have heard of, so many years on, they're younger than Red Storm, as it were, is Rainbow Six. So they're still out there, aren't they? I mean, it's quite significant.
Well, I'm not a gamer, never have been and never will be, and I've never played any of the games that I had my name on them. But we just sat around with a bunch of really highly intelligent people, gamers, game mad they were, and said, "Well, what have people not done?" And there were shooter games where you just run around shooting everything in sight. There were strategy games, there were board games. And we alighted on the idea of mixing strategy and shooting. All the gurus in the games business said, never work. Anyway, we came up with Rainbow Six, which was allied with a book which Tom wrote called Rainbow Six as well. And the book came out, and then 4 weeks later, the game came out. But of course, Tom's audience, book readers, were not gamers. So what we did was to get one of the gaming magazines to take chapter one of the book and put it in a gaming magazine, which introduced Tom Clancy to gamers. And then they all rushed out and bought the game. And it was a world number one. And we changed we invented a new genre, as they say.
Yeah, that's quite amazing.
And it was fun. Hard work.
I bet it was, yeah. And particularly that period when it was all very new, and computers, I suppose, hadn't yet delivered the capability to deliver what was in the minds of your creators, you know, under your charge, as it were, in the company.
Yeah.
So with Rainbow Six being such a huge success and breaking new ground, what was the path forward for the company and your involvement in it?
Well, it was quite meteoric. In 4 years, we went from sales of zero to $80 million by expanding, leveraging, as they say in America, Rainbow Six and sequels. And then we produced another game called Rogue Spear and sequels. And by that stage, apart from the Millennium bug, we were looking forward to Tom Clancy getting married. And he honored me by asking me to be his best man. So I got to meet some really rather senior people in the entertainment industry in New York, giving my best man speech. And then in 2000, after we got over the Millennium bug, we sold the company to the French billion-dollar company Ubisoft, which has kept the Red Storm Entertainment brand as a studio in North Carolina. And the company has recently celebrated its 26th birthday. So I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, and that's quite an amazing thing. You're a pioneer.
Yes.
Very much.
And I still can't play any of the games.
No. Yeah. But the mid-90s, that period, did you have, aside from running the games company, founding it with Tom Clancy and all that, did you have any interesting encounters with your former foes under the sea, the Russians? Did you meet any of them?
Yes, I did. There was a film made about a Soviet submarine which actually sank off the east coast of the USA. It was a true story. And in the course of making the movie, Igor Kurdin, who was the XO of the submarine, but reported sick the day before it was due to sail, and he had some kind of flu and didn't go on the trip. Somebody else did and died. But Igor was in the States to advise on the movie. And we all, Tom, Igor and I, met in Baltimore along with Igor's minder. And we had a very enjoyable evening. He drank prodigious amounts of alcohol. I've never seen anything like it. But he's still going strong, and he now runs the Russian Soviet Submarine Museum in St. Petersburg. Lovely man. We exchanged a few notes about our different careers and what we've been up to, but nothing secret.
No.
It was all good friends.
No, yeah. So, I mean, for me, as much as you and anybody, I suppose, that has studied naval history or Cold War history, the recent turn of events is quite extraordinary and, you know, unbelievable, really, that we should now be back in an era where we're in a new Cold War at sea, on land, you know, between us, the West, NATO and Russia. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think this Cold War has been going on for some time. I mean, it's not something the media gets too excited about reporting. But from my understanding, what I hear snippets, I don't hang around the Navy anymore. I don't. The last thing you need is some old guys hanging around asking too many questions. But the Russian Navy went into big decline in the 90s. And then started rebuilding. And I would say that the Cold War in the Atlantic has been going on for at least 10 years. It's not as it was in my time, because our defense forces have been much reduced in the swords into plowshares stuff, whereas the Russians have been through that and come out the other end, and we haven't. So they are much more capable now. And they're probably less predictable than they were, because Mr. Putin doesn't think like some of his predecessors. So it will be an exciting time to be at sea in a submarine now, but probably not with the advantages that we had, because we had a technological advance on them. Nowadays, it'd be much more of an even match, I would think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. It's certainly a challenge. It's a different challenge on a different scale and in a different way. And, yeah. Anyway, that was a brilliant discussion, Doug. Thank you for coming on the podcast and having a chat. And I very much appreciated listening to all your various stories and insights.
Ian, it's always a pleasure to chat with you, and I much enjoyed the afternoon. Thank you very much.
And for more about current day submarine operations, including the new Cold War, please take a look at Warships IFR, because we frequently cover developments there. And for anybody that wants to dive into the Cold War under the sea, I can offer my book Hunter Killers, which tells the story of Cold War submariners and submarines of the Royal Navy during their many different missions, including the deployments in which they had very close encounters with icebergs, particular kinds of icebergs, which were in reality Russian submarines. And to this day, the UK Ministry of Defence will not admit that the iceberg incidents involving Scepter and also Warspite were in fact collisions with Russian submarines. Thankfully, they didn't end in disaster, but they're still nonetheless exciting and quite terrifying to read about, and that's part of the narrative in Hunter Killers. When it comes to HMS London, the paperback of my book HMS London has just been published, in which you can read about Doug's exploits in command and also all of the various warships called London in the history of the Royal Navy. And in fact, the next HMS London will be a brand new anti-submarine warfare frigate. Anyway, it's all in the book, HMS London. For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at Warships IFR, and also Twitter at Warships IFR. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.